Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 1, Just Who is this Patriarch Judah? The Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 3, July 1998, from the 1998 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmaheiser, read by Dan Adams. Introductory Note. In this letter, Clifton gets downright passionate defending Tamara's virtue and honor. I doubt I can equal his fire as I deliver his words. Nevertheless, the message for all in Christian identity is to do likewise, because Tamar's actions, as revealed in Scripture, turned out to be crucial. In this lesson, we are clearly presented with a view of Tamar in opposition to the usual Pharisaical moral bigotry most of us have received in Judeo-Christianity in connection with the story of Tamar and Judah, which, by the way, always completely ignored the implications for the bloodline of Christ. They never ever mentioned it, almost as if the half-Canaanite clowns Judah made with his Canaanite wife would ever have been good enough for Yahweh, or for that matter, for us. Just Who is this Patriarch Judah? Part 3. With this issue, I would like to present a study in connection with Tamar. What's in a name? Meaning Tamar's name. What's in a name? Let's go into the falsity of calling Tamar a Canaanite, let alone a Canaanite whore, for she was neither a Canaanite nor a whore. There is more to studying than pointing to a geographic area on a map and saying that all the people in that area are Canaanites. This is what Scott Vaught did, and this is what many unqualified teachers like him do. As you know, people are portable, and you simply cannot pin them down to a point on the map. This is how many people pretending to be qualified Bible teachers make the mistake of claiming that Ruth was a Moabite. We will also be going into this thing about Ruth being an alleged Moabite later. It is therefore necessary to realize that people migrate from area to area because of weather changes, or they are displaced by wars, and many other reasons. Insert here, famine, as recorded in the scriptures, was a reason for families, even nations, to move. Politics properly understood is to involve the ability of a ruler or class of rulers to move people from one location to another for the ruler's purposes. This was also a factor operative in ancient history, and it is certainly alive and well up to the present moment as a device of our enemies. Continuing. You can see, then, it is necessary to take time frames and migration into account. This is something which Scott Vaught and others like him do not do. This is an example of how we are getting so many false teachings in Israel identity today. This is an example of some of the same kind of reasoning we are getting from people like Ted R. Whelan, Stephen E. Jones, James W. Brueggemann, Charles Weissman, etc. At this time, let's check the scriptures and determine Tamar's origin once and for all. It is found in the book of Jasher, chapter 45, verse 23, and it reads thus: "And in those days Judah went up to the house of Shem and took Tamar, the daughter of Elam, E-L-A-M, the son of Shem, for a wife for his firstborn Ur." Clifton Emmaheiser is about to get into Tamar's name, but notice that Tamar is described as a daughter of Elam, the son of Shem, this being the stem of the Persians, of whom perhaps a few millions may have yet managed to survive unmixed in Iran today. The Canaanites and Arabs have nothing but enmity for the seeds of Shem, including the modern pure-blood Iranians, though they do not possess the scepter. Judah and Tamar were both from Shem, and so therefore their offspring were pure Shemites. Continuing. But first here, in the case of Tamar, we are going to consider the meaning of her name. Tamar is number 8559 in Strong's Concordance. 8559, Tamar. The same as 8558, Tamar, the name of three women, and a place called Tamar. It is also necessary to consider number 8558, as it also refers to her, 8558 Tamar, from an unused root meaning to be erect, a palm tree. This meaning erect or palm tree may not seem like much of a portrayal of this name, Tamar, when we first think of it. Tamar is spelt T-A-M-A-R. But let's take what we have here and go to a good thesaurus and look up all the synonyms we can find in English to see what all this can mean. One of the first synonyms we find is upright. Can we then say that Tamar was an upright woman? Erect means not leaning or laying down, not inclined or bent, but upright. It can also mean exalted, to rank high in character and honor. Is not the idea of being elevated in rank or character a good attribute? It appears that this lady Tamar had something going for her, that she was not just another run-of-the-mill ordinary person. She was something special. It appears that the term exalted is not out of line for this lady Tamar. Another word for erect can be dignified. Dignified means stateliness and nobility of manner, serenity of demeanor and gravity, solemnity of manner or behavior, dignified reserve. Are we starting to develop or portrayal in our minds of what kind of a lady this Tamar was? That she was a common whore is absurd. It appears that this lady Tamar was a woman to be looked up to, not down on. Another word for erect is distinguished, which means conspicuous for qualities of excellence, celebrated, eminent, and famous. It is starting to look like we have quite a lady in this Tamar. Another meaning for erect can be ennoble, which means to make honorable, having or indicative of excellence or dignity, and characterized by or displaying superior moral qualities. It appears that we have no ordinary lady in this woman. Another synonym is honorable, which means worthy of honor or respect, having eminence or high rank, illustrious, brilliantly outstanding. Are you beginning to see that these Hebrew words have a lot more meaning than it would first appear? Honorable can also mean a strong sense of what is right, high standards of conduct, including chastity in women. Well, you say, this woman Tamar proved that she was of low moral character. However, I believe after we have re-examined her story very carefully, we will find otherwise. Now, to go on with these synonyms, another word for erect is honest. Honest means not given to lying, cheating, and stealing, acting honorably and justly, being trustworthy, also characterized by openness, sincerity, being frank, and having integrity. I don't know about you, but what I'm beginning to see in this Tamar I like. Another quality for this erect woman is being conscientious, which means being scrupulous, careful, thorough, and painstaking. It seems that Tamar was a meticulous lady, a stickler for details. Do you know any ladies like that? I'll bet they ain't Hottentots or Canaanites. And I don't apologize, as Messiah called non-Israelites dogs, Mark 7:27. Also, the word erect suggests just, a word which means adhering to a high moral standard, upright, honest, equitable, well-founded, substantial, fitting, and proper. I think we are getting to know this erect woman, Tamar, a little better, you say. This was a terribly immoral thing she did with Judah. Let's examine her story further, since the significance of her true role has been ignored. Another word for this woman is scrupulous, which means cautious in action because of a wish to do right. This woman, Tamar, had scruples. Another word to describe erect is true. Being true means faithful to friends, promises, or principles, loyal and steadfast. Nothing false or erroneous about this Tamar. Another word here for erect could be glorious or full of or deserving glory, renowned or illustrious, also resplendent or beautiful. One can almost envision this beautiful woman, Tamar. Another word here for erect is grand, which means noble or dignified in character or manner, majestic, stately. Another synonym for the word erect would be elevated. And Scott Vaught has the audacity to claim that Tamar was a common Canaanite whore. Another word for erect could be lofty, which means elevated in character, quality, and style. We're not talking about a two-bit whore here. Another word is sublime, meaning characterized by elevation, nobility, grand, solemn, highly serious. Another description is superb, meaning very good, supremely fine or outstanding. This lady, Tamar, stands head and shoulders like a palm tree above other women. Another erect term could be inspired, which means to influence by example or be an inspiration for other women to follow. This lady, Tamar, was really a woman to be looked up to, a woman perceived as different, set apart, outstanding. Another term that could be used for erect is eminent, which means high in station, merit, or esteem, distinguished, prominent. Prestigious is another term that could be used for erect, meaning having a high estimation in the eyes of people, integrity. Is another word that might be used for erect, meaning uprightness of character, unimpaired or sound. It can also mean the state of being whole, entire, nothing lacking. I don't know about you, but I think we have a real, true Adamic woman here, not a hook-nosed, slimy Canaanite kike. Another word for an erect or upright person could be illustrious, meaning notably or brilliantly outstanding, greatly distinguished, renowned. When we get into the final story, you will understand why Tamar is all of these things. I could go on and on with this thing about Tamar's name. I'll mention some of the other words, terms, and synonyms I found, and then go on to other things. These are illustrious, noble, great, prominent, renowned, proper, faithful, appropriate, suitable, fitting, worthy, pure, meticulous, resolute, steady, ardent, loyal, genuine, constant, right, veracious, V-E-R-A-C-I-O-U-S, seeking the truth, legitimate, majestic, royal, stately, magnificent, splendid, towering, lofty, gorgeous, impressive, sound, salient, remarkable, confident, sincere, superior, reliable, trustworthy, admirable, commendable, meritorious, virtuous, can't help but be good, beneficial, mannerly, neat, unadulterated, undiluted, unmixed, principled, righteous, chaste, intelligent, authentic, no copy, certain, consistent, staunch, immovable, precise, determined, resolute, fervent, glowing, keen, reliable, capable, competent, qualified, comely, which is, means pretty, decent, respectable, clean, presentable, apt, delicate, refined, pleasant, and stunning. So, do you think this Lady Tamar was something special? To sum up the situation, we can say that Tamar was a person of good character, of superior rank, worthy of respect, inasmuch as she was correct and proper, being legally and morally right. She was a woman of scruples, being ethical and of a noble and spiritual nature. She was a woman of completeness, adherent to a code of values, and a woman of perfection, widely known and honored. She was a woman having a fixed purpose, firm in position and sure of movement, a woman worthy of esteem, an entire woman, healthy and fit, free from foreign matter, racial contamination, or corruption. A woman neat and orderly, conforming to a standard of right behavior, devoted to right principles, acting or being in accord with what is just or moral. Extremely careful in attention to details, being very meticulous. She was a heedful woman, understanding the situation at all times, conscientious and aware of the law of what was right or wrong to Yahweh, dependable and reliable to do the right thing when necessary. She was a loyal woman in fact as in appearance, a genuine woman, tried and true. She was unchangeable, immutable, strict and exacting, firmly fixed and settled, and in agreement with fact and reality. She was unyielding in purpose, truthful when necessary, mentally alert, well-balanced, and took authority of her actions. She was characterized by warmth of feeling, ardent and filled with passion, fair in complexion, attractive in appearance, and like a palm tree standing erect and upright in impressive dignity above the other trees. I would like Mr. Scott Vaught to know right here and now, Tamar was no Canaanite whore, as he has alleged. Now, for another version of the story of Tamar, this is from a book, A Far Above Rubies, by Isabel Hill Elder. I highly recommend this book to anyone who is studying the Israel identity truth. A copy of this book should be in every racially conscious Israel home. This would have been a good book for Scott Vaught to read, for if he would have read it, he would not have made so many stupid statements. I'm going to quote pages 32 to 35 of chapter 5. This will give us again more insight into the story of Judah and Tamar. This is not the end, though. For later, I am going to go into each facet of this story, and when we have examined it thoroughly, I believe you will be amazed at the end result. Tamar, Genesis 38. Judah, fourth son of Jacob and Leah, in direct disobedience to the Hebrew unwritten law of marrying within their own race, as so signally demonstrated in the cases of Isaac and Jacob, in obtaining wives of their kindred in Haran, married a woman of Canaan. Three sons were born to them, and as the mother in those ancient times had entire charge of the children, these sons were brought up in the ways of the Canaanites and without the respect for morality which ever marks the worshipper of the true God. You know, to Isabel's words, I would say here that God's moral law is written into the hearts of them, therefore they know it by heart. The other races do not. And God even considers it blasphemy for them to pretend that they know his law. Continuing, Judah had long since realized his mistake in marrying a woman of Canaan and determined that his sons should have wives of his own race, as if that would help. A Hebrew lady with a Hebrew name, Tamar, the daughter of Aram, she says here, signifying palm tree. No, correcting Isabel here in this place, the wrong patriarch. Jasher had it as Elam, not Aram. Close cousins, though they remain. Continuing. Was chosen by Judah for his elder son, who was the nephew of Abraham, except that was a half-breed Canaanite. These sons appear to have been addicted to all the sins and wickedness of the Canaanites. First, died shortly after his marriage, and the next son, Onan, refused to obey the Hebrew law of the next eldest son by marrying his brother's widow. Judah became alarmed when Onan died. We are told that the Lord slew him also. Judah now feared to give Tamar to his youngest son, Shelah, lest peradventure he die also as his brethren did. And from this comes all the mythology concerning Tamara, T-A-M-A-R-A, the deadly seductress, more popular in Eastern Europe than anywhere else, and for those interested in pursuing this turn of research. Judah returned Tamar to her father's house, there to await his pleasure. In the meantime, his Canaanite wife, Bathsheba, died. Tamar, in the belief that her father-in-law Judah would marry a second time a woman of Canaan, determined to remedy the racial descent problem in her own person. And actually, here I say, probably she figured that if she didn't get a son from this man, that she would end up old and childless and therefore helpless in a world where, if you didn't have the protection of a man, you starved to death. This was, after all, 4,000 years ago. Continuing. A relative of the Jacob household, and well aware of the necessity for racial purity in that house, Tamar embarked upon a course which would prevent Judah's immediate descendants being other than Hebrew, which would have been within the house of Eber. And a very self-sacrificing course it turned out to be. It was masterly strategy which brought about the meeting of Judah with his daughter-in-law by the wayside, as recorded in the 38th chapter of Genesis. And the pledges given by Judah, with which he was later confronted, put all denial beyond peradventure. Thus, by Tamar's self-sacrificing action, the royal enclosure within the house of Judah was saved from contamination by forbidden bloodstock. Tamar was well aware that in taking the course she did to preserve the purity of her race in the house of Judah, she ran the risk of being burnt by fire. And it was not until she was brought forth to receive this punishment by her unsuspecting father-in-law's command that she revealed the true state of affairs. Discern, I pray thee, whose are these? The signet, the bracelets, and staff. The signet or ring was the emblem of power and authority. The bracelet was the cord, usually of gold, from which the signet was suspended, and the staff, which also signified the scepter, emblem of authority as head of the tribe. In the family records which were handed down from father to son, Tamar would learn of the care exercised to preserve purity of race, and would learn that her great ancestor Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations from Seth. The word Tamar means whole, flawless. Twin sons were born to Tamar and named Phares and Zarah. Phares, became an ancestor of our Lord. Shelah, the youngest son of Judah and Bathsheba, became quite an important house in Israel, but was disqualified by divine intervention because of his spurious birth from becoming an ancestor of the Redeemer of Israel. Judah, in his story of Tamar, states that he lived a good and pure life until he met Bathsheba the Canaanite. I said to my father-in-law, I will take counsel with my father, and so will I take thy daughter. And he was unwilling, but he showed me a boundless store of gold in his daughter's behalf, for he was a king. And he adorned her with gold and pearls and caused her to pour out wine for us at the feast. And the wine turned aside my eyes and pleasure blinded my heart, and I became enamored of her, and I transgressed the commandment of the Lord and the commandment of my fathers, and I took her to wife. And the Lord rewarded me according to the imagination of my heart, inasmuch as I had no joy in her children. I turned aside to Tamar, and I wrought a great sin. For I gave my staff, that is the stay of my tribe, and my girdle, that is my power, and my diadem, that is the glory of my kingdom. And indeed I repented of these things. Wine revealeth the mysteries of God and men, even as I also revealed the commandments of God and the mysteries of Jacob my father to the Canaanitish woman, Bathsheba, which God bade me not to reveal. For the sake of money and beauty I was led astray to Bathsheba the Canaanite. For even wise men among my sons shall they mar, and shall cause the kingdom of Judah to be diminished, which the Lord gave me because of my obedience to my father. For I never caused grief to Jacob my father, for all things whatsoever he commanded I did. And Isaac, the father of my father, blessed me to be king of Israel. And Jacob further blesses me in like manner. And I know that from me shall the kingdom be established. For the sake of money I lost my children, and had not my repentance, identical to Esau's condition, and my humiliation in the prayers of my father Jacob been accepted, I should have died childless. But the God of my fathers had mercy on me because I did it in ignorance, and I learnt my own weakness while thinking myself invincible. Of the four women mentioned in connection with the ancestry of our Lord, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, Tamar is the first to have the honor of taking a definite step for racial purity, and it was indeed a great tribute which Judah paid in his pronouncement. She hath been more righteous than I. Genesis 38:26. Now, wasn't this quote from that book Far Above Rubies by Isabel Hill Elder about Tamar better than all of the women of the Bible by Edith Dean in lesson number 2? While both articles had something to contribute, this later one was much the better of the two. While both articles had something to contribute, there's still more to be said about this story. The only way we are going to completely understand this story is to break it down into its component parts and analyze it as the story develops. As the story develops, we will have to take every aspect of the law into account, as this story is guided much by the laws of Yahweh. Now let's tell the story the way it really was. It mentions in Genesis 38:1, Judah went down from his brethren. Now this was a very serious mistake on the part of Judah to leave his own kind. Anytime we go slumming with the Hottentots or cat and dog eaters, it is going to lead to problems. Again, I don't apologize. Mark 7:27. But Jesus said unto her, Let the children first be filled, for it is not meet to give the children's bread and to cast it unto the dogs. Anyway, here is Judah, and he goes down to this Canaanite slum to the house of one Hira, an Adullamite. There Judah meets an enticing female, we really can't call her a lady, the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. Genesis 38:2. Now before we go any farther with this story, it is mandatory that we identify what a Canaanite is, or we will miss the whole point of the story. Here is where people like Ted R. Wieland, Stephen E. Jones, James W. Brueggemann, Charles Weissman, etc. get into trouble, as they just do not identify the subject they are talking about. It is absolutely necessary, therefore, to identify the origin of the Canaanite at this time. If you will go to Genesis 15, verses 19 through 21, you will find that the Canaanites were made up of Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaims, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. These were all intermixed and generally called Canaanites. The first mention are the Kenites, who are the descendants of Cain. Numbers 70:14 and 70:17. The Kenizzites are the descendants of Esau, Edom. The Raphaims are descendant of fallen angels. And from this, you can begin to see what a bastard race these Canaanites were and are. With the Kenites, these people had the bloodline of Cain, who was fathered by Satan himself. Well, this Canaanite wife of Judah had the satanic blood of Cain in her, and she was related to the serpent of Genesis 3:13 through 15. Once we understand this fact, we can begin to comprehend the plot of the story. What is the plot of Satan, then? The story all started in ages past in the heavens, where Lucifer and a third of the angels followed him in rebellion against Yahweh. Then Yahweh placed his own son and daughter in the Garden of Eden, Adam, and his genetic identical twin, Eve. At this point, Lucifer decided he must destroy the sons and daughters of Yahweh before they could grow great in the earth. Lucifer decided also that he, Lucifer, must plant seed children of his own in the earth to counter the children of Yahweh. Therefore, he, Satan, must seduce Eve and cause her to have children by him. Lust played only secondarily in this matter, as to produce progeny of himself was his main goal. Ever since that time, he has been breeding up his own kind, while at the same time trying to kill or crossbreed down the children of Yahweh. This is why, at every critical period of history, Satan's children are right there ready to do Satan's bidding. That is why Herod, an Edomite, Canaanite, descendant of Cain and Esau, was Johnny on the spot to kill all the little boy children in order to kill the promised Messiah. Remember? It was Rachel who was weeping for her children, not Leah. Herod wanted to kill the heir to the house of David, who would have been of Judah, who was mothered by Leah. But he ended up killing a lot of Benjamite children instead. Remember? Rachel had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. When you come to understand that there is a war between Yahweh's children and Satan's children, then the events of history become evident. Right now, Satan's children are trying to crossbreed Yahweh's children out of existence, and you don't even have to look very far to see it. And you have to be blind if you don't see it. Well, the story of Judah here is one of those stories that happened at a critical time in history. Knowing that this Bathsheba was a Canaanite, satanic descendant of Cain, and what her motives naturally would be because of her satanic nature, let's see how the story develops as we continue. From what I have been able to find, Judah was only about 15 to 16 years old when he meets this daughter of the Canaanite. Although the Testament of Judah, 151, says that he was 20. It may have been a 4-year process of acquaintance. Anyway, at this age, he would have had the body of a man and the mind of a child. He was live bait for this Canaanite bitch, and a bitch she proved to be. Think of this story in the reverse of Satan seducing Eve. In this case, it is Bathsheba seducing Judah. This is a critical point in history, as Judah was to be the seed line from which the Messiah would come, and one of Satan's children, Bathsheba, was right there to try to defile that seed line. That is why Yahshua told the scribes and Pharisees in John 8:44, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father ye will do." He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. Let's now take a look at the trap that was set for Judah by these satanic people. It was more than Bathsheba, as her father was in on it too. We'll read from the Testament of Judah, of the lost books of the Bible, and the forgotten books of Eden, chapter 1, verses 51 through 53, and then chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. I was 20 years old when this war befell, and the Canaanites feared me and my brethren. And I had much cattle, and I had for chief herdsman Iram the Adullamite. And when I went to him, I saw Parsaba, king of Adullam. And he spake unto us, and he made a feast. And when I was heated, drunk, and sexually excited, he gave me his daughter Bathsheba to wife. And I knew that the race of the Canaanite was wicked, but the impulse of youth blinded my mind. And when I saw her pouring out wine, owing to the intoxication of the wine, I was deceived and took her, although my father had not counseled it. Again, we have more in the Testament of Judah, chapter 3, verses 3 through 10. Since I also gloried in that wars, fighting and killing, no comely, pretty woman's face ever enticed me, and reproved Reuben my brother concerning Bilhah, the wife of my father. The spirits of jealousy and of fornication arrayed themselves against me until I lay with Bathsheba the Canaanite and Tamar, who was a spouse to my sons. For I said to my father-in-law, I will take counsel with my father, and so will I take thy daughter. And he was unwilling, but he showed me a boundless store of gold in his daughter's behalf, for he was a king. And he adorned her with gold and pearls and caused her to pour out wine for us at the feast with the beauty of women. And the wine turned aside my eyes and pleasure blinded my heart. And I became enamored of and lay with her and transgressed the commandment of the Lord and the commandment of my fathers. And I took her to wife. And the Lord rewarded me according to the imagination of my heart, inasmuch as I had no joy in her children. And now, my children, I say unto you, be not drunk with wine, for wine turneth the mind away from the truth, and inspires the passion of lust, and leadeth the eyes into error. You can see here that it was not only Bathsheba, but her father also, who was in on this conspiracy. Had this conspiracy worked, there would have been no Messiah. And if we don't see this last point, we miss the whole story. What we have in this instance is one more case where the children of Satan are doing the work of their father to destroy the children of Yahweh. This war has been going on now for about 7,500 years. You will also notice, like all Canaanites, this father of Bathsheba had plenty of gold, like a typical Canaanite merchant Jew. Now, that's a good start, but there is more. Well, Judah ended up having three children by this Canaanite, Bathsheba: Onan, and Shelah. Just to show you how much of a bitch this Bathsheba was, Genesis 38:3 tells us that Judah named the first child and when the next child, Onan, was born, Bathsheba named it. Genesis 38:4. This tells us that she was taking over the head of the household and usurping Judah's rightful place as priest of the family. Canaanite treachery is connected with matriarchy in all its facets. From this point on, this Canaanite bitch was running the show, and we will see just how she manipulated it. Well, these three sons grew up, and it came time for them to find a wife. Judah knew the rules, but in spite of this, he went to the house of Shem to find a pure white woman for his half-breed son, That sounds like the problems we are running into today. Where are we going to find wives and husbands for all of these half-breeds of today? Of course, like Judah, we will try to find a nice white girl for them, right? And if we oppose that idea, we will be politically incorrect, right? I'll bet that Judah never told Elam, Tamar's father, the whole story, or Elam would have never given his pure white daughter Tamar for Judah's half-breed son because the Canaanites were some relation to Ham, the white son of Noah. Maybe he passed off as being white, you know, one of those almost white Canaanite Jews. Now, what we have to know next in this story is the fact that Bathsheba, Judah's wife, wanted her sons to marry among her race. And this explains a lot of what happened later in this story. The Canaanites were a very low moral people, and Bathsheba taught her sons the lowest forms of immorality. At last, the day came for Tamar to become Ur's wife, And we will pick up this story in the book of Jasher, chapter 45, verses 24 through 27. This gives a better description than in the King James Version. And Ur came to his wife Tamar, and she became his wife. And when he came to her, he outwardly destroyed his seed. And his work was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And it was after the death of Ur, Judah's firstborn, that Judah said unto Onan, Go to thy brother's wife and marry her, as the next of kin, and raise up seed to thy brother. And Onan took Tamar for a wife, and came to her, and Onan also did like the work of his brother. And his work was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him also. And when Onan died, Judah said unto Tamar, Remain in thy father's house until my son Shelah, Shiloh, peace, tranquility, shall have grown up. And Judah did no more delight in Tamar, to give her unto Shiloh, Shelah. For he said, Peradventure he will also die like his brothers. Let's take the same passage from the King James Version for comparison. It would be Genesis 38, verses 6 through 10. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And Judah said unto Onan, Go in unto thy brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to thy brother. And Onan knew that the seed should not be his. And it came to pass, when he went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. If this is true, consummation of the marriage was never completed, meaning that Ur did not legally become Tamar's husband. Judah, not knowing about Ur, verse 8, said unto Onan, Go in unto thy brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to thy brother. Now, this is what is supposed to be done under the law, except that Onan, being a bastard, is technically not under the law. He is rather a violation of that law. Every move that is done here is according to the law. You cannot understand Tamar's position unless you understand the law. Then in verse 8, Onan objects because he wants his own seed rather than his brother's. Why? Because Onan wanted the birthright so that the inheritance would pass through him. This half-breed Canaanite Jew had his eye on the money. Now, Onan was so adamant about this situation that he withdrew himself before completing consummation, coitus interruptus. Thus Yahweh killed him too, Onan, a half-breed, because of his satanic Canaanite nature. Had no respect for the laws of his father's mighty one. And to this day, this act is called Onanism. Technically, look it up, Onanism, O-N-A-N-I-S-M, a technical name for masturbation or coitus interruptus. Continuing. Be this as it may, I would rather believe Yahweh killed Ur and Onan to protect Tamar. Now this is getting interesting, as neither Ur nor Onan could be considered Tamar's rightful husband before Yahweh. She was never really married to either one, because there was no consummation in either case. Now, this sets the stage for the rest of the story. We're simply told here that Judah sent Tamar back to her father's house until Shelah would be grown up. When Shelah was grown, Bathsheba, wanting all of her sons to marry Canaanites, took charge and married Shelah off to a Canaanite, and then she died. The Testament of Judah bears this out. Chapter 2, verse 19, when Judah says, "And while I, Judah, was away, she, Bathsheba, went and took for Shelah a wife from Canaan." You can tell from this act alone what kind of a bitch Bathsheba was. We have to give Bathsheba, Judah's Canaanite wife, credit here for two things, though. One, she married Shelah off to another Canaanite. And two, she died. After this, the King James Version says, Genesis 38:12, "And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Bathsheba, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted, and went up unto his sheep shearers to Timnath, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. Well, this brings up some very interesting situations about this story that most Bible students have never considered. They are the contract to furnish seed from one of the sons of Judah for Tamar to have children was a total breach of contract on Judah's part, because his sons were all bastards. Through the death of Bathsheba, Judah's wife, Judah was a free at-large eligible widower, and so could be married to anyone eligible to marry him. As neither Ur nor Onan properly consummated their marriage with Tamar, she was still in essence a virgin until the very night on which she seduced Judah, at which point Yahweh accepted the opportunity to form new life, Phares and Zerah, and accepted a consummated marriage between them. Tamar puts her life on the line for her true children. The first thing we must observe, understand, is that Tamar knew Yahweh's law. Do you know it as well as she did? Therefore, it is important to consider her behavior from the viewpoint of her knowledge of the law. At this point in her life, Tamar realized she had no future without Judah's children to carry on his kingly line. Nevertheless, she was just as happy not to have children by any of these half-breed Canaanites. Tamar, no doubt, breathed a sigh of relief when Shelah, last half-breed son of Judah, was married off by Bathsheba to her own kind. But now that was all over, and if she were going to act, it would have to be now or never. At this point, there was only one way that Judah could live up to his promise, and that would be if Judah himself were to father Tamar's children, thereby acting in accordance with the law. And now she considered, if she were to have children by Judah, it would be in accordance with the law, inasmuch as they were both pure-blooded eligible spouses for marriage. And the most important thing, the children would be of pure blood. Thus Tamar very quickly embarked upon a very dangerous plan of action, for if her bold plan didn't work, Tamar was a dead daughter-in-law by the very law she acknowledged. How would you like to face being burned at the stake? This took a woman with real guts to take the actions she did. In reality, Tamar was no ordinary woman. Where are today's Tamars, whose only purpose in life is to beget and raise children of their own kind? Tamar knew that Judah had been deprived of his sex life for some time as a result of Bathsheba's death, and knew of Judah's drinking problem when he got together with the boys, especially during sheep shearing season, with his old Canaanite friend Hira the Adullamite. Tamar took everything into account, especially the law, and then she took action. I believe the rest of the story here is very beautiful, how she handled each detail, how she obtained his signet, bracelets, and staff as a pledge to keep her position safe. I am real proud of Tamar as she is my grandmother. I don't know how many times removed, but had she not done what she did, I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't be writing this Watchman's teaching letter. I'm especially proud to share Tamar, my grandmother, with Yahshua himself, as we both have a common ancestor in her. Everyone who is of German, Scottish, or Irish descent have Tamar for a grandmother. I'm not a bit ashamed of Tamar for what she did. It is only regrettable that she was forced to cohabit twice with those half-breed Canaanites. And I thank Yahweh that he slew both of them forthwith. Actually, Tamar is one of the most exalted women in Scripture and one of my favorites. Clifton may assert these tribal connections, but it is not as clear as he makes it out to be. There are, reputedly, elements of all 12 tribes among the Germans. Anyone in Britain of genuine Roman blood could also be authentic Judah, if any may remain. It is possible that Clovis the Frank was also of Judah, and certainly from earliest modern times, the French are also Germans. Continuing. There's one more thing we should like to take into account with the story of the birth of Phares and Zerah. Now with the birth of Phares and Zerah in Genesis 38, 29, and 30, Phares is counted as Judah's firstborn, and Zerah as Judah's second in line. It is obvious that the first two Canaanite children by Judah were not counted. In other words, Ur was not counted as the firstborn, nor was Onan counted as second. For in Genesis 38, 29, and 30, Phares is counted as Judah's firstborn and Zerah as Judah's secondborn. For some reason, Shelah continued to be counted as thirdborn. Evidently, with the death of Ur and Onan, it left open the first and second positions for Phares and Zerah. I believe with this Watchman's teaching letter you will never look at the story of Judah and Tamar in the same light again. If you listen to most nominal Christianity, they will hypothesize what they consider to be Tamar's immorality. I am here to tell you it was just the opposite. The reason most people come to the conclusion that Tamar's action was immoral is because they don't study deep enough or just listen to someone else and their opinions. In the next teaching letter, I will go farther into the story of Judah. It will not only be the story of Judah and his personal life alone, but the life of his descendants. There are a lot of twists and turns with Judah, so there will be a lot to talk about. But what we know for now is Judah was and is a very important tribe in Israel, as it is the tribe from which our Redeemer came. Without the tribe of Judah, there would be no salvation for Israel. Without Tamar, there would be no tribe of Judah. Now, how many Bible teachers are bringing you truths you need to know, such as you have just read? Can you now see why I claim my teachings are an extension of Bible researcher and former attorney Bertrand L. Comparé and Dr. Wesley A. Swift? Revised on the 14th of February, 2001, by Clifton M. Heiser. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 3. Thank you for listening.